What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome to The Exchange, folks. I'm Tyler Matheson, in today for Kelly Evans. Here's what we got on the docket for you. The bull market has room to run, and the recent volatility has presented great opportunity. That is according to one of our guests today, and he's here with what makes him so optimistic and the three names he likes right now. Plus, Boeing's loss may have been smaller than expected, but it was an ugly quarter. We've got the latest on earnings, on the CEO search, and how quality control issues are being handled at that big manufacturer. And three more names on deck to report, including a big one, Meta. They were just talking about it there. We've got the story, the action, the trade into the print, but we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu, who has the numbers. Hi, Dom.
All right, so Ty, today's bull run, at least today's bull run, trying to kind of build on the last couple of days, is losing some steam steadily throughout the course of the late morning into the early afternoon session. The S&P 500 is only down 0.25%. It's only 12 points to the downside. We're currently at 5,058 for the trade, so down 12, but at the highs earlier today, we were up roughly 19 points and down 23 at the lows of the session. So we've been kind of losing a little bit of steam throughout the course of the day. The Dow Industrial is down about 0.33%, 117 points at the downside, 38,384. The NASDAQ Composite just about flat, so outperforming so far, only down about 10 points. But again, it was solidly higher earlier in the session, the Composite Index at 15,686. Some of the earnings headliners today that we've been talking about include some big upside movers. We'll start on the travel and leisure side. Hilton Worldwide up about 4.5% right now. A good quarter for them. Better than expected earnings and revenues. They raised their guidance for the full year. So Hilton Worldwide doing some at least beneficiary work for the travel and leisure sector, up 4.5%. Another one to watch is the single best performer in the S&P 500. And it's all about fun and games. Hasbro shares up about 10% or so. A beat for profits, a beat for revenues there as well. So Hasbro, thanks in part to better inventory management, better digital game sales. Remember, this is the parent company of brands like Transformers, G.I. Joe, and Dungeons & Dragons. Watch Hasbro. And then the second biggest stock in the S&P 500, but probably the bigger influence these days. Tesla shares up about 10% right now, $159 and change per share. It would actually miss results on both profits and revenues, but a lot of optimism about the possibility of a more affordable vehicle model coming at the later part of this year or early 2025. Tesla shares a big focus here. Ty, I'll send things back over to you.
All right, Dom, thank you very much. It is a big week for the economy with PCE on Friday, the gross domestic product tomorrow. And critical to that GDP report will be a number that isn't even technically part of that report. It's the productivity number. And it has ignited a debate among Fed officials and economists about whether or not the data signal a boom or just a blip. And our senior economics reporter, Steve Leisman, has the latest on that. A debate with the Fed and economists. You got to love to see the fur fly.
Right. Well, there are members of each side within each group, right? Mm-hmm. You got your Fed folks who are optimists and pessimists, and some of your economists as well. The growth in productivity, Tyler, is often the biggest part of how the economy grows. And there's a critical debate underway about whether we're seeing a post-pandemic noise in the data, or is it a real boom? Here's the data. For the 5 years before the pandemic, productivity grew at a trend like 1.4%. From the beginning of the pandemic through the first quarter of last year, it dropped to 1.3. You had a massive surge at the beginning of the pandemic. It was followed by a really worrying decline. But it's come back big. The past three quarters have seen an off-the-charts number average of 3.7%. Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee, he laid out last week how critical it is for the Fed to get this right.
That's fundamentally going to change everything about the economy in a way. And it would have direct implications for monetary policy. It would put us back in an environment that would very much be like the late 90s, where you could have faster wage growth without inflation. You could have faster GDP growth.
Okay, but there are skeptics out there who say this is all post-pandemic noise in the data, that you have work from home, but these hours are being mismeasured. And, of course, it's too soon to tell because productivity is really best measured over scales like 5 years or even 10 years. The optimists say, you know, work from home could be a source of greater efficiency with better matching of productive employees with their jobs, companies learning to do more with less from the pandemic, and higher growth and inflation forcing them to higher productivity measures. Fed Chair Jay Powell, he's been in the camp of, well, a little bit skeptical, wanted to see more data. But on Squawk Box this morning, former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Jason Furman, he summed up what you could consider to be the middle ground.
What we're seeing in the data is just noise and post-pandemic gyrations. What we're seeing when we read about what's happening in AI, the developments in company, the developments in the technology, I think that's real. It's just not in the data yet.
Okay, to preempt the question here, for the Fed, it means higher productivity could mean lower for longer. It's like adding factories and workers without really having to add either. Getting there, though, can mean more demand for capital to invest in those things that create the more productivity. So short term, that could mean higher rates until the productivity begins to take hold.
First, I love when economists talk about gyrations. It just gets me going. But let me ask you, just from a dumb point of view, what is productivity? How do you measure it?
Yeah.
And then what influences or changes it for better and worse?
Okay, so productivity is efficiency or output per hour, which you can imagine, Tyler, in a service sector economy is very difficult to measure.
Yeah, I wouldn't know how you would measure my productivity. I fear you won't. But
let's say you were a journalist.
Yeah.
Ah, I think that's a real example.
Okay.
Let's say you used to write 5 stories a week, and then somebody gave you a computer. Remember, you probably used to use the carbon paper in the whiteout?
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's say you would increase that to 10 stories a week. Now, let's assume there was no change in accuracy, which would be a measure of your output, okay, or would affect your output. And let's say you got paid the same for that and worked the same number of hours to do 10. That would be an increase in productivity. So there are more stories there for the same amount of inputs. Well, of course, you have to measure the capital input as well from that computer.
So is improved productivity largely then driven by technological advancement, like better computers, like AI, like using data in a more effective way?
I would like to answer that question, yes, but it's not 100% true. Technology is a big part of it, but business process is another part of it. Let's say you figure out a way to gather information or you'll say you find a better source for your story that has more has the information more quickly. That's not technology. That's business process. If you figure out how to do something more quickly. And then there's another thing. It's called TFP or total factor productivity. OK, get ready for this. This is what the economists call manna from heaven. They actually do call it that. Let's say you've measured all the capital you've put in. Let's say you've measured all the labor you put in and you still have more productivity on top of that. It's the added value of TFP. That's the good stuff. That's the stuff we're really looking for, where it's not just dollar for dollar increase in productivity for the capital and the technology.
It's not just throwing more capital. It's not just throwing more people. It's just
added value productivity that happens from changes that have been made. Now, that's the thing the economists really look for. It's also the hardest thing to measure because it's really you've got to account for all the other inputs into it. It's what's left over after you think you've accounted for everything. Look, Tyler, we grow 1.5% productivity a year. That's sort of normal base rate. The debate we're having now is, has that number ratcheted up?
So that the pace of
productivity...
3.7?
3.7. It's almost certainly not
that. It's certainly a blip.
That would be crazy. One way to think about it is this. Let's say you have a printer, and that printer puts out 100 pages a minute. And then you get another... the next generation printer goes 101.5 pages per minute. That's normal productivity. But what if in the next generation it puts together 150 pages a minute? That's a quantum step in productivity growth.
Yeah.
That's
Steve,
what we're looking for.
Thanks for the explanation.
Sure.
Thank you very much. All right. Now we're going to move and talk a little bit about 5-year notes. They are up for auction, and Rick Santelli has the action at CME. Rick.
Yes, Tyler. And as I'm talking, of course, look at an intraday chart of fives. You're not seeing much movement. Actually, we're starting to see rates creep up a bit. The auction, the grade for demand is straight up 1 Eastern by investors for today's 5-year. My grade was a C. Straight average across the board. Let's go through it. $70 billion record offering of 5-year notes by the U.S. Treasury came in at a yield of 4.659, which was about a half a basis point above the when issued market. higher yield, lower price, and of course, we're the seller on the government side, so but that really accounted for some of the mark. But all the other metrics, pretty much, were on top of 10 auction average. Some were a little below, some were a little above. The one that struck out that was a little above was the direct bidders at 19.2%, but pretty much straight across the board average. If we look at the longer term charts, we could see that over the last couple weeks, interest rates have ramped up a bit for new high yield closes for the year. As a matter of fact, going back to November. That is an issue that we need to pay close attention to and break it down versus supply issues, debt servicing issues, and, of course, some of the data like we're going to receive Friday and how it affects the Fed, which, of course, affects the market. Tomorrow will be the last of the supply with seven-year notes. Of course, they're not going to be the record demand, the record supply we've had in twos and fives. Tomorrow's $44 billion is not the largest seven-year, but the package of twos, fives, sevens at $183 billion is a record. Tyler, back to you.
All right, Rick Santelli, thank you very much. Well, 28% of the S&P 500 companies have reported earnings so far. 79% have beat the estimates by an average of 9.4%. Now, that's good news for the companies and for my next guest's market thesis, because he says earnings are the key catalyst that will keep the bull market going. He's Matt Orton, chief market strategist at Raymond James Investment Management. Matt, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be back, Tyler. Good to see you.
Yes, you the same. Let's talk a little bit about earnings and what's coming up. I guess we've got your Metas. We got a bunch of other ones later on. Anything that you're particularly going to be paying attention to or keying off of?
You know, Tyler, I think what you said to start this is the key. Is that earnings growth overall for the market, that's going to be the key arbiter of whether this bull market continues or not. And so far, I would say earnings are coming in very, very nicely. EPS is coming in ahead of expectations. Revenues are coming in ahead of expectations. And so that's all positive. Obviously, I think from a sentiment perspective, what we hear from the mega caps coming up. So we've got Meta, we've got Microsoft, we've got Alphabet this week. You've got a host of the rest of the mega caps next week. That, I think, is going to be very important in the short term. But overall, I think what we're seeing is that there's a broad number of companies across sectors and industries that are reporting good numbers. And to me, that supports this idea that we are seeing a broadening out of the market. We're seeing a rotation beneath the surface. And when I talk to clients, that's what I tell them to lean into. Whether or not the market's down because yields are moving higher, I think you have to be looking long term. And to me, I would be using downside opportunistically because the fundamentals are still in place, and there's plenty of good opportunities across sectors and industries right now.
An awful lot of the folks that we have on our air here, like you, these days, are talking about small caps. And a lot of people have been talking about small caps for a long time. And so I guess I'm kind of from Missouri. Show me the money here. When is that going to happen? Or is it happening?
Yeah, I feel like small caps are almost turning into the international trade for the past decade, mm-hmm. where we're saying maybe they're actually going to outperform. And we're still waiting to a large degree. But I think small caps are not a monolith. When you look at something like the Russell 2000, that's not an index I would recommend any client own on its own, because there's so many companies that don't make money. And a key part of my market thesis, Tyler, is that you have to own quality. Going forward, you have to own companies that have a path to earnings or have earnings, have free cash flow. That's all really important. And when you look beneath the surface at small caps, there's a number of high quality companies that don't have significant leverage, that have strong balance sheets and can expand, and are leaned into a lot of the trends that I like increasing CapEx, bringing reshoring back to the US, the artificial intelligence revolution, but being powered by data centers and the build out needed for that. So I think that's what's going to move small caps. And if we can start to get an inflection point with respect to earnings for small caps, I think that's what gets the market moving, because it's so under-owned by investors right now. Mm-hmm. I think once you get a little bit of momentum, the flows will beget the flows, and you'll see some really strong upside there.
Let me make sure I heard you correctly, because I'm afraid maybe I didn't. Did you say to not go with the Russell 2000 because too many of its constituents don't make money, and rather to go with small cap companies, maybe individual choices, where the profit picture is better, the balance sheets are better, the debt is lower? Did I understand?
That's exactly right. Or go with an active manager that's actively picking stocks. Right. And so you can lean into growth, you can lean into value. But owning the index overall, you've got 2,000 companies with, you know, questionable quality across maybe 750 of them.
Right. You like small caps, you say, and cyclicals, including Energy, NextEra, Vertiv, and VanEck Oil Services ETF. Explain.
That's exactly right, Tyler. I think cyclicals right now have the opportunity to keep outperforming, and it's a hedge in many ways against inflation right now. So you look at the industrial complex, which is where Vertiv fits. You know, Vertiv just crushed earnings this morning. It's been a top pick of mine for a while because they're levered to data center growth. They provide cooling systems and power management to data centers, which we know we need to invest in a lot more of them going forward. And so they're a high quality company. It was a high quality beat. They're generating more free cash flow. Balance sheet leverage is coming down. So it ticks a lot of my boxes. You know, when you look at something like a NextEra, you know, they pay a dividend. I think dividend growers have been underappreciated by the market overall for the better part of a year or so. And when yields do eventually come down, investors are going to need dividend growth. But NextEra has its own avenues of growth. It's the largest renewable provider of solar and wind energy in the world. They also just provided good earnings yesterday, and there's visibility to it. Their backlog's increasing. So that, again, it fits the higher quality beat, plus you get the dividend component. And energy's been a great trade. Energy hedges some of the inflation and geopolitical risks that we're facing right now. And so what I tell clients is, it's tough given the gains in some of the energy names now to just pick one single stock, but oil services have been left behind relative to refiners, relative to some of the exploration and production names, Tyler. And so what I would say is buy the OIH because you'll get broad exposure to the servicers, and we need to extract more oil from the ground with less CapEx and using less balance sheet, and this is a name that ticks those boxes.
All right, Matt, thank you so much. Matt Orton with Raymond James. We appreciate it. See you again soon.
Great to see you.
Thank you very much. Let's turn to housing right now. New data show just how sensitive buyers are to any movement in rates right now, and our Diana Olick has that story. Hi, Di.
Hey, Taya. Mortgage rates rose for the third straight week last week, hitting the highest level since November. The average on the 30-year fix for conforming loans increased to 7.24% from 7.13%, and that's for loans with 20% down, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. As a result, applications to refinance a home loan, which are most sensitive to weekly moves in interest rates, fell 6% for the week. They were 3% higher than the same week 1 year ago, though. Applications for a mortgage to buy a home fell 1% for the week and were 15% lower than the same week a year ago. As home prices rise along with interest rates, potential buyers' purchasing power are suffering a double whammy. Now, as often happens when affordability takes a hit, the adjustable rate mortgage share of applications rose last week to 7.6%. ARMs offer lower rates and can be fixed for up to 10 years, although they are considered riskier loans. Now, these numbers were all for last week, so I want to take a look at what's going on today. Rates had dropped a little bit to start this week, according to Mortgage News Daily, but they made a U-turn, a tiny tick higher today to 7.39%. The next potential big move would be on the monthly employment report, of course, at the end of next week, Tyler.
Diana, thank you very much. Diana Olick reporting. Well, the Senate, as you probably know, has passed a bill that potentially could ban TikTok in the U.S. We'll look at what's next, what this means for U.S. users, and what will happen to TikTok's algorithm. But first, shares of Boeing down 32% since that door plug blowout back in January. So did today's report and words from the outgoing CEO Dave Calhoun shed any light on a turnaround in the company's culture, quality control, and its investment potential? Before we head to break, check out shares of HashiCorp surging on another report of an IBM takeover. Wall Street Journal headlines yesterday, Bloomberg now reporting Big Blue will offer $35 a share for the software provider. HashiCorp up another 9%. The exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Boeing posting a smaller-than-expected loss per share and free cash flow burn, but sentiment still shaky as investors and travelers alike look for clarity on production and quality control following that door plug blowout in January and other issues. Here's what outgoing CEO Dave Calhoun told Phil LeBeau on Squawk on the Street this morning.
The review is going well in the sense that we're both approaching it business-like. We all want the same thing. We want a factory under control. We want a set of metrics that demonstrate it's under control month to month to month to month. And then we want compliance on the floor. Are your tools in the right place? Are the instructions set up the way they're supposed to be? We want that to be as perfect as it can be. Easily measurable, and I think at the end of 90 days, they will simply say, we agree with this control plan. We will measure it, and you will have to demonstrate performance every step of the way.
But as negative headlines about production quality continue, it is unclear if Boeing is yet out of the woods. So let's bring in two experts to shed light on the situation. Joining us now is Oscar Munoz, former United Airlines chairman and CEO, and Jeff Gazzetti, former FAA accident investigation director and a former NTSB investigator. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. Jeff, let me start with you. How do you grade Boeing so far in terms of transparency, clarity, and action in correcting the production issues that they seemingly are facing?
I tell you, Tyler, I'd have to say it's a B plus. I think they're saying all the right things. I think they're trying to be transparent. I would not have given that grade, say, 4 months ago. But it seems like they have gotten some religion since that plug door blew out in January 5th. And so I think they're saying all the right things and they're moving forward.
And are they doing the right things from where you sit?
That's a tougher nut to crack. And I think Mr. Calhoun said it right there that they need to show these tools to the FAA and they need to show measurement of meeting those tools on the factory floor, as well as their safety culture and everything else. The jury is still out on the actual implementation.
Mr. Munoz, do you derive confidence from Mr. Calhoun and what Boeing seems to be doing? Your airline was a big customer of Boeing's, and I'm sure you have a level of trust, if not devotion to them.
They're, as we all discuss, they're a great company. Yes, there's a lot of trust. There's a lot of hope that this works itself out for so many different reasons. It's a great asset to the United States of America's sort of manufacturing power. It is a great source of commercial activity for the services airlines, as well as the State Department or the Defense Department. But, you know, the progress, as Jeff has mentioned over the course of time, is what everybody's been waiting for. What are you doing and when are you going to have it done by? And so we've seen the management shakeup. We've seen the development of a plan, a little bit of proof of the promise, which is important. And the issue will be financially whether they, you know, those delayed orders, and they have a huge backlog, as you know, it all points to something positive, but they've got to get past this perception, the media pressure that's on this. And with that, they've got to get some really strong communications out there because nobody's hearing it other than the negative that gets reported every time something happens with an aircraft.
How much, Mr. Munoz, how much trust have they lost among airline executives and the people who are negotiating contracts? How much trust have they lost and how do they get it back?
Well, trust is a commodity. And yes, it's been lost. And the way you get it back is you re-earn it. And you're going to re-earn it by delivering what you said you were going to do. And in a world of practical sort of capital markets world, it's going to cost you. people, you know, the demand that's been there for a long time will still be there. But I think they're going to have to, you know, for lack of a better term, give better pricing, better deals to all the right people because of all the delay that it causes. It has really been impactful to several airlines around the world about their growth plans. These are plans that are built literally years in advance. And, you know, you hire pilots and crew and resources for that. And to have to shut that down and ratchet it back down, it's a painful, if not an economic hit to people's growth plans. And so how do you pay that back? How do you re-earn that trust? It's going to take more than just bringing a good aircraft. It's going to take a lot, I mean, and a lot of trust building.
Mr. Gazzetti, how much, how candid with the flying public can, or with the investment community, can Mr. Calhoun truly be? Is he in any sense restricted in what he can say, or from a competitive viewpoint, in what he should say about where Boeing is, what it's doing? Are they in any way restricted by the NTSB or the FAA?
No, Tyler, they're only restricted in specifically talking about the actual investigation that NTSB may be doing. So the NTSB is hot and heavy with the door plug investigation. They're going to have a public hearing on it. So anything related specifically to the door plug incident in January, he cannot talk about. But other than that, he can talk about anything else, how well their safety reporting program is, how they're building their safety culture. So, you know, I think Oscar's right. Boeing has a steep hill to climb in terms of communicating what they're trying to do and to improve their safety. And they just got to keep trying to do that because they do want to tell a story. And they can tell that story as long as it's not specifically related to the plug door accident.
Let me just finish with a blunt kind of cudgel of a question for both of you. Do you trust Boeing and do you trust flying on Boeing airplanes? Jeff, you go first.
I'll answer the latter one first. I do trust flying on Boeing airplanes. I think I don't have any issue flying on any type of Boeing airplane to include the MAX. Do I trust Boeing, period? The jury's still out on that. I think they have done some things to lose my trust, and they're slowly building it back, but I'm not there yet.
Mr. Munoz, same question.
Yeah, flying on aircraft. Now, I'll answer that question from a pilot's perspective.
Sure.
And I talk to many pilots every time I travel. They don't have any reservation about flying on aircraft. So safety is there, and that's not an issue. I trust Boeing as well, but we don't know what's coming. We don't know who the new CEO is going to be and what he or she is going to be able to do. And I think the real level of answering that question is time to tell, not because of Boeing and its wonderful, incredible people and professionals, but because the leadership is still sort of in a mix there. And so ask us that later, and we'll have a better answer, I think.
I don't mean to embarrass you, Mr. Munoz, but if they called, would you take the call about the CEO job?
Well, thank you. I'll stay off that pattern for now. There's enough speculation going around with so many different people. So, listen, it's a great company.
Understand. Mr. Oscar Munoz, thank you. Jeff Gazzetti, thank you as well. Appreciate your time today. All right, we will hear from two airline CEOs tomorrow. American Airlines President Robert Isom will join Squawk Box in an exclusive at 7:20 Eastern. Southwest Bob Jordan joins Squawk on the street at 9:30 a.m. You'll see both of them. Don't miss them. That's tomorrow on CNBC. And still ahead, IBM, Caterpillar, and Meta getting ready to report. We've got the key things to watch and how to position into the print. Plus, AI in healthcare. We'll speak to the CEO of one company that is leveraging the technology to simplify and streamline, it says right here, the healthcare billing process.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Bertha Coombs with your CNBC News update. Ukraine has started to use long-range missiles secretly provided by the U.S. to hit areas held by Russia, according to a New York Times report citing senior U.S. officials. The Army Tactical Missile Systems, called the ATACMs, were used to bombard Russian airfields in Crimea last week. President Biden had approved the delivery of the missiles early last month in a $300 million package, and the U.S. will provide more in the new aid package the president signed just today. Meantime, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. will be sending new military assistance to Ukraine. In a statement, the State Department noted the $1 billion package would provide munitions and equipment for Ukraine to use immediately on the battlefield. The announcement comes after President Biden signed the National Security Supplemental Package today. And more than a quarter of U.S. adults over 50 years old say they don't expect to ever be able to retire, according to an AARP survey. For many, it's just a financial issue. They cited everyday expenses like housing costs, including rent and mortgage payments, as the biggest reasons why they're unable to save. Tyler, one in five have nothing saved for retirement. That's just a really scary proposition.
Depressing, shocking. Thanks, Bertha. All right, coming up, Meta shares nearly flat ahead of its earnings after the bell today. Can the company deliver on AI and ads? We will dig into that next. And don't miss, do not miss the 2024 CNBC stock draft featuring WWE superstar Charlotte Flair, NBA champ Kenny Smith, and more. That's tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern on Power Lunch. It's going to be fun. You don't want to miss it. All right, welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Another member of the Mag 7 set to report this afternoon. You've heard the name before. We've got the action, the story, and the trade on Meta platforms. That's one. Plus Caterpillar and IBM. New Street's Delano Sapporo is here with our trades. Let's start off with IBM. The shares, Delano, up nearly 33% in the past 6 months. Stiefel flagging the software growth there. Red Hat bookings and its consulting business is some of the key factors. You, sir, are a big blue believer.
I am a big blue believer, Tyler. Thanks for having me. So a lot of things with IBM's strength is the interconnectedness of their offerings. And I think that's a big reason why their customers are so sticky and you have those inch up in the switching costs. So I like what IBM is doing. I think they performed, you know, somewhat well with the execution part of it. But if you look at their balance sheet is somewhat strong. They have areas where they can grow, especially in the consulting side of the business. So I like what they're doing. I'd be a buyer here.
Been a long while since I've looked at IBM stats and seen it up 46% over the past year. Let's move on to Caterpillar, up 60% over the past year. Bank of America includes a potential rebound in China demand and lower copper prices as potential growth catalysts. You like B of A. You also like Cat's balance sheet.
I do like Cat's balance sheet. So they have a strong balance sheet. They're in a position where we're in a high inflationary environment to still do well. Well, if you look at what's been happening domestically and abroad, there's infrastructure spending still happening, and that benefits Caterpillar. And I think a little bit of why the shares have performed so well, especially if you look how they've done over the past 6 months. So I still like it here. I think we're still going to fare economically better than expected, even better than I expected. And so I think the shares will do well. We've seen commodity prices fluctuating, but they're actually starting to even out. And I think that benefits Caterpillar.
All right, let's move on to Meta. That's one that a lot of people have their eye on for this afternoon. The second best performing mag name with shares up more than 130% over the past year. Ad revenue growth and expense management, those are two things in focus. What are you looking for this afternoon, Delano?
Continued growth on the top and bottom line for Meta. This stock's performed really outshine, as you mentioned, for the Mag 7. I think there's still more room to grow. They've done a great job of exceeding and changing their advertising tools, and it seems like, you know, customers are adding, really liking what they've done because you've seen the advertising revenue come back. Some other growth areas for them, the initiatives on the metaverse. I think that's a long-term shot. They're still showing a loss there on their reports for that. But, you know, overall, they've got an opportunity here with Reels. They got an opportunity with Threads. And I think they're building such an ecosystem that it's only going to benefit Meta. And I'd be a buyer here as well.
All right, Delano, thank you very much. Delano Sapporo, New Street Advisors Group founder and CEO. Thanks very much. Always good to see you. And speaking of Meta earnings, let's move on. A key metric investors will be watching for is the company's ad business, as digital ad sales contributed 97% of Meta's revenue. So will this growth continue into the first quarter? Let's bring in advertising expert Mountain CEO Mark Douglas. Mark, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Good. We usually see you on the stock draft, right?
Yeah. Well, I was hard to compete with, NVIDIA this year. Yeah, I think Netflix did well, but
you can't beat NVIDIA this year. Let's talk about incredible growth at Meta in the ad business year over year through the last quarter. What are you looking for this quarter, and can they keep it up?
I think they are going to keep it up. So Meta, I think what last year showed is when they get very focused, they have a lot of leverage in the business. And a lot of that leverage comes from the advertising tech. Essentially, if they can drive more visits to a brand, more revenue to a brand, that brand's going to step up to the plate and spend those dollars. And so that's what happened. I think that will continue. And also, I think Q1, at least in Mountain's business, is off to a really nice start. And I think the same is happening with Meta and Google and others. So I think it's just going to be an overall great quarter. And I think they'll continue that. I don't see anything that will slow that down in the foreseeable
their
future.
Their ad revenue, let's see, 25% year on year. Total impressions and price per ad, that has been delivering very well. So on all of the advertising metrics, this thing is hot as they come.
Yeah. The thing about Meta is all other ad platforms kind of descend from Meta. So if you go to TikTok, you go to, Pinterest, you go to any of these companies, they're almost all staffed by people who are at Meta. So they literally wrote the book on this and they're very good at it.
So let's talk a little bit about today's news, and that is the potential that TikTok will be banned in the United States. I don't know whether that will happen. There's a lot that needs to happen between now and that point. There will be legal challenges, potentially constitutional challenges. But if it were to happen, would Meta be the principal beneficiary?
I think that they would be one of the big beneficiaries. But it won't occur overnight. The way performance advertisers think, it's like they're managing a portfolio of marketing dollars. And just like in the stock market, sometimes you just think, I'm just going to sit it out. So it's not like those dollars are just going to instantly shift to Meta if that were to occur. But they and others, Amazon, others, hopefully my company, would all benefit over time. But it wouldn't be like, quarter over quarter, like just a massive shift to any of those companies, including Meta.
Mark, always great to see you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Mark Douglas of Mountain. All right, still ahead. Speaking of TikTok, we'll get what's next for its key algorithm. The Exchange will be right back. President Biden wasted no time. He has signed the bill that bans TikTok unless the Chinese parent company ByteDance sells it within about a year's time. But a sale would require figuring out how to break off a key technology that differentiates the app, the algorithm. Dieter Bosa digs into that for today's Tech Check. Hi, Dee.
Hey, Ty, and that algorithm is really all that matters. TikTok's algorithm, it is a black box, but it is also the most important thing about the app. Now, without it, any potential buyer is buying something with a lot less value. Many have tried to get at the source code, and while some have revealed its strategy, its broad strategy, and its impact, especially on minority groups and teens, none have been successful at uncovering the actual detailed workings. The company, like many tech companies, keeps its algorithmic processes confidential as proprietary information. What we do know, though, is that it uses a combination of machine learning techniques and user behavior analysis to optimize content delivery. Now, the New York Times in 2021, they got a hold of an internal document called TikTok Algo 101. That was in 2021 that outlined four main goals. They were user value, long-term user value, creator value, and platform value. But TikTok, which did confirm the doc's authenticity, said it was written to explain to non-technical employees how the algorithm works. So in other words, no source code. And that is a big part of how TikTok has remained on top. And you can see here, continues to keep users engaged better than copycat apps like YouTube Shorts and Instagram's Reels, Ty.
Interesting. So it's the algorithm that lies. Who owns that? ByteDance owns that? And would a buyer of TikTok gain that or not?
Unlikely that Beijing is just going to hand it over. So you're right. The parent ByteDance owns that algorithm, developed that algorithm, I should add, in a very different internet technological landscape that exists in China. It's very unlikely that Beijing is going to let go of that easily. You have a potential buyer like Steve Mnuchin say that he could rebuild the app in the U.S., but some of the folks I talk to think that is just like a laughable concept, because look at Mark Zuckerberg. He has been trying to recreate the TikTok algorithm through Reels. He certainly had some success, but he hasn't been able to create the same algorithm with the same kind of engagement that TikTok has. And then you look at a Snap, like an Evan Spiegel, right? It's difficult even for them, even though they know that this is such an effective tool, maybe the only tool that matters right now in keeping folks on your platform.
So reverse engineering this algorithm is probably a non-starter?
Some people think you could. A lot of the folks I speak to in tech and investment in tech think that is a tall, tall task and nearly impossible. And just the idea that Zuckerberg has probably hired hundreds, if not thousands, of data scientists to do so and still hasn't been able to exactly create that.
Isn't quite there. All right, Dee, thank you very much. Dee Drabosa reporting. Coming up, recent analysis by KFF of healthcare.gov revealed that on average, insurers deny almost 20% of claims. We'll talk to the CEO of a tech company leveraging AI to help patients gain protection from those rejections and the increased costs that come with them. That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Shares of Humana falling despite strong earnings after the company pulled its guidance for 2025, citing Medicare price hikes. The insurer had previously warned increasing medical costs would impact results this year and beyond. But on a call with analysts today, Humana said costs weren't running ahead of projections. Joining us now to discuss that and how his company is lowering costs for patients using AI is Mike Desjardins. Desjardins, the CEO of Anomaly. Mike, I hope I didn't butcher your name too badly, but welcome nonetheless.
No, thank you for having me. And actually, you said it perfectly, probably too perfectly for my Americanized family.
I'll be darned. Now, let's talk about Anomaly here, because this is an area I'm fascinated by, because I get vexed, frankly, every single time I try to understand an explanation of benefits from my carrier. And I'm living it right now in a very personal way. Can artificial intelligence help me understand what I'm being charged, why I'm being denied, or claims are being kicked back to me? And then on the flip side, won't the insurers similarly use artificial intelligence to stay one step ahead of dummies like me?
Well, for starters, I'm sorry that you're having the experience you're having and going through what you're going through. So, all my best
to you.
But yeah, you'd think it would be that simple, but it's not. So, I think that the short answer is yes, AI can absolutely help. And I think where it starts is understanding and really driving transparency into what is covered, when and why, which sounds like it's table stakes, but we've all bought health plans and clicked on that more information tab and we got more pages and less information. But I think, the fundamental thing we found is that there are 540 million different combinations of codes that your provider needs to be able to bill appropriately to get you paid and to get your explanation of benefits on point. And that is a computer challenge, not a person challenge. And that's what we do.
So how does AI alleviate or ameliorate those problems? And am I, as a customer, or is the insurance person in my physician's office going to speak to an artificial intelligence source to explain what they need? And is that source going to be able to understand it?
So the short answer is we operate behind the scenes. So what we do with artificial intelligence is we take in all of the data that your provider is sending out and all of the data that your insurance company is sending back to essentially construct transparently what should transpire with that claim or with that encounter. So you, as the patient, just get the care that you need and get a clear explanation of what should happen, and ideally don't get a bill in the mail if all goes appropriately. But yeah, to your specific question, there's lots of ways that your doctor's office can tackle it, but we are trying to remove the work of even having to ask an AI. And just give them the right information in advance.
Back to that question that I kind of buried in the first one. Insurers are using AI too, I'm sure. And in ways that may obfuscate or may hasten denials. How do you respond? How are you going to stay ahead of what they do? Or are you going to partner with them?
Sure. In the future, I hope to partner with them. And I think providers and payers can partner together kind of on transparency using these technologies. Right now, though, providers are bringing on the AIs that you're using. They're using, payers are using their own AIs, and right now they're fighting each other. And I don't think that's a good future for anybody. I think both sides are trying to reduce costs. You see it in Humana's earnings. Their MLR is up kind of in the high 80s. They're used to it being kind of in the low 80s. Those are the costs that they're hoping to control. So right now it looks like, you know, utilizing AIs to remove some of the administrative costs on their side. In the future, they should use them to come together.
Forgive me for injecting my personal perspective on this, but it seems to me sometimes, in my experience, that insurers make the system unnecessarily complicated. They may reject claims for whatever reason, on the hope that I will do what a lot of people do, and that is just say, oh, well, what the hell, I'll pay it anyway. Am I right about that or wrong?
You know, I can't speak to the motivations, but I can speak to the complication of getting that done. And for an individual like me or you to fight somebody like Humana or United, that's a pretty daunting task. And, you know, I think the different gates that you might put up, like a prior authorization, you know, they are infrequently fought, you know, less than 10% of the time. They're frequently won more than 80% of the time. So to me, that is an area ripe for change and something that, you know, we need to do something about.
Mike Desjardins, we thank you. Anomaly CEO, I think we'll have you back again. Appreciate it, Mike.
Thank you very much. Absolutely.
You bet.
Really appreciate being here.
That does it for The Exchange. Power Lunch is next. Contessa Brewer is over in the next studio. I'll join her after this break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.